All right, so what it wanted to do there is this. We'll go ahead and talk about covenants. And this particularly, what we're going to talk about is the new covenant. But we're not going to go through and spend a lot of time parsing out the new covenant and its ramifications and going through all the various scriptures about Paul and all that stuff where people take and they think that the new covenant is this or that and it does away with the old covenant and all that stuff. We're not going to go through all that. That's not my purpose today. My purpose is just to continue on as we have been to describe why it's important to be in covenant with God. And the new covenant is one of those things that, in, especially in Messianic circles, we really, I think, misunderstand. We use the term renewed covenant and stuff like that and try to explain what the covenant is all about. And I think a lot of it is because we truly, truly, really don't understand the meaning of the new covenant. So we're just going to take and just look at the word or the text of the new covenant and see what it has to say about itself and study it that way. We're going to try to really just study it in the context of the Old Testament and then possibly tie it into the New Testament. So let's go through and let's read real quickly the covenant, and then we'll be referring back to these things. Jeremiah 31, verses 31 through 33. "Behold, the days are coming, says Yahweh, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt, my covenant which they broke, though I was a husband to them, says Yahweh. But this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, says Yahweh. I will put my law in their minds and write it on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they will be my people. No more shall every man teach his neighbor and every man his brother, saying, Know the Lord, for they all shall know me, from the least of them to the greatest of them, says Yahweh. For I will forget their iniquity and their sin I will remember no more. Thus says Yahweh, who gives the sun for a light by day, the ordinances of the moon and the stars for a light by night, who disturbs the sea and its waves roar, if those ordinances depart from me before me, or depart from before me, says Yahweh, then the seed of Israel shall also cease from being a nation before me." Now, as most people quote the new covenant, they generally leave out this portion of it right here, verse 35. And for obvious reasons. Because the same people that will take and use the new covenant text in the New Testament, or the apostolic scriptures, to support their view that God is doing a new thing, this does not support the view that this is a new thing. Verse 35 does, right? Doesn't, right? And I'm going to go ahead, but I'm going to have to move quickly through this.
I just want to say, I read that for the first time, you're like, that's Matthew 5:17. Yeah. The last latter part, you know? This yeah. Far from me, before since the Lord, then the seed is with all those who came to me before me forever. Not a doubt to the whole thing.
Right. So, actually, the new covenant, you could say, goes even on. I mean, if you continue to read the text all the way on down through chapter 32 of Deuteronomy, you can still see passages that relate to this new covenant concept. But the question in many people's mind is the new covenant really new? And so let's look at that real quickly and see. There again, in Messianic circles, we tend to say, we call this the what? The renewed covenant, right? Thus saying that this covenant is not the same covenant, or this covenant is the same covenant God made at Mount Sinai. And God is simply going to renew it at the end. Well, we're going to look at that from both sides of the issues, and we're going to try to determine ourselves if it's a new covenant or if it's a renewed covenant. All right, so the word new in this text comes from the Hebrew word kadash, which means new and fresh. All right, and that's just the way it is. That's whenever you look at that word kadash, you pretty much see the words new associated with it in every place else it's used. But the word kadash comes from the root word kadash, which means to renew or repair. And anytime you see this vowel pointing here in the Hebrew, that indicates that is the root of the word. That's the pael form of the word. And so this is the root, and it's kadosh. But again, remember, when did vowel points come into effect? About 1000 A.D. Around 1000 A.D. is where we get vowel points. All right, so let's look at another word that's closely associated, and that is the word kodesh, right? And the word kodesh is the word from which we get the word new moon. And as we know, when we look at the new moon, are we looking at a new moon or are we looking at a renewal of the moon? We're looking at a renewal because we don't get a new moon every year or every month. God doesn't take the old one out and send it off into outer space, wherever it is, and then bring a new moon in. We get the same moon, but for us, it's renewed. Okay? It's a new cycle, right. So when we do this little study here, we could say that, well, the new covenant can truly be a renewed covenant. Keeping in mind then that vowel pointings were not in effect when this was written, all we have are the letters. The Hebrew, well, I can't get rid of that, can I? All we have is the hey, the dash, I mean the het, the dalet, and the sheen. And so, if you notice, it's the same in every one of the words. All right. So a reader in the first century could look at that and they wouldn't know if it's new or renewed unless they look at the context. And so this is what we would need to do, and we would have to study the context. So let's look at the context of Jeremiah 31. And the context is pretty clear. It's all about the restoration of Israel. It's Israel finds rest. Israel's gathered from all directions. And Israel is restored. And so if we compare that, this context with the Sinaitic covenant, the covenant at Mount Sinai, do we see connections? Well, yeah, we do. We do, obviously, because if we look at Leviticus 26 and 27, we see the blessings and the curses. Okay, but at the end of the curses, what do we always see? A restoration. And the same thing in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 28 and 29 talks about the blessings and the curses, but then when you go on into Deuteronomy 30, you see restoration. God says, even after all these things, I will draw them back. So in that regards, the book of Jeremiah, or the chapter 31 of Jeremiah, could be simply talking, and is simply talking, about the restoration of Israel. And so when you have the covenant put into the end of the text there in chapter 31, then you would say, okay, well, this is talking about the same thing we see in Torah. So therefore, it's a renewed covenant and not a new covenant. And this pretty much is the logic I think many people tend to follow as they study into this and try to determine, you know, what this is. Is it a new or a renewed covenant? One of the things we also need to do, okay, so it appears to be an extension of the Sinaitic covenant. But there's questions, okay? We have questions we have to answer in order to determine if this is a new covenant or a renewed covenant. One of the questions is, if this is a new covenant, what happened to the old covenant? Okay? If this is a new covenant, what happened to the old covenant? If you notice, Jeremiah 31 never says anything about an old covenant, does it? But we would assume that if there's a new covenant, then there is an old covenant. And that would, we would suggest, would be the Jeremiah or the Sinaitic covenant. What happened to it? We don't know. We know through our previous studies on covenants that how do you end a covenant?
Death.
By death. All right. So then we would assume that if the old covenant is done away, then the parties involved in the old covenant are dead. And remember, we're following a suzerain model. And just a real brief rehearsal or rehash of that, a suzerain model is where you have which the covenants that God makes are based on suzerain models. I mean, it's just, we've gone through that before, and I can go back through that again sometime later. Or you can read this on our website, because we have it on the website. But the suzerain model is that you have a great big nation, then you have a little small nation, And the great nation offers to protect the small nation if the small nation will agree to certain stipulations. And as long as they've agreed to the certain stipulations, then the big nation takes care of the small nation. I mean, that's it in a nutshell. The small nation and the king of the small nation and the king of the big nation, they generally, when making a covenant, will take an animal, cut it in half, walk between the parts of these two of this animal that's cut in half, and they will. And by doing so, they are basically stating that if we break our terms of the covenant, then will happen to us what happened to these animals. That's what a suzerain covenant is all about. All right, so we got this one question. What happened to the old covenant? If we have a new covenant, what's the sign of the new covenant? Because as we saw in the suzerain model, practically every covenant has a sign. All right, so what is the sign of the new covenant? And in Jeremiah 31 passage, we don't see a sign listed. Who is party to the new covenant? And for the sake of people who have the Christian bent, who often think that they are a part of something new, that Christianity is a new religion, you might ask, why do Christians tend to negate the major aspects of the new covenant, which is Torah observance? And why do they also reject Israel, who are the partakers of the covenant, or the parties in the covenant? Does the new covenant follow the nesting pattern of the previous covenants? And what we saw before is that the previous covenants of God, the covenant with Noah, the covenant with Abraham, the covenant with Israel, all fit within a nesting pattern where one fits within the other. And that without the Noahic covenant, there's no way you could have the covenant with Abraham, because God could not promise something forever if he had not first promised how long forever would be. So this is the concept that we're looking at there. Does the new covenant have provisions not found in the old covenant? And some of the things we find in the new covenant are forgiveness of sin and the law written on the heart. Both of these we do find mention of in the Sinaitic covenant, especially in the book of Deuteronomy. So these are all questions that we could ask that would tend to make us think this is a this is a renewed covenant here in Jeremiah and not anything new. And it looks like that's where the evidence is pointing. And then finally, does the new covenant have a sign? Actually, I have that listed up here at the top, so I got that twice. Now, to understand a little bit more about the new covenant, though, not only do we need to understand the text of Jeremiah 31, we also need to understand what's going on in the days of Jeremiah. Because Jeremiah is living in a period of time that's very unique in history. The northern tribes of Israel have been banished away. The southern tribes have basically turned against God. And here's Jeremiah out there, a lone voice amongst all the people, trying to tell them that, hey, we're going to have to repent or we're going to be taken captive like the northern tribes. And the king just brushes Jeremiah off and says, no, that ain't going to happen. In fact, he puts Jeremiah in prison. But this here is a pretty good example of what Jeremiah is facing and what the people of the southern tribes, Judah, are facing at this time. It says, then Yahweh said to me, proclaim all these words in the cities of Judah and in the streets of Jerusalem, saying, hear the words of this covenant and do them. Which covenant is he talking about? Okay, the Sinaitic covenant, right? The new covenant's not been even mentioned yet. For I earnestly exhorted your fathers in the day that I brought them out of the land of Egypt, until this day, rising early and exhorting, saying, obey my voice. Yet they did not obey, nor incline their ear, but everyone followed the dictates of his evil heart. Therefore I will bring upon them the words of this covenant, which I commanded them to do, but which they have not done. What were the words of the covenant that would befall them if they simply stopped walking in the ways of God?
They'd be cursed.
And the curse was that they would be scattered. The curse was is that they would be scattered. The curse was not that they were going to die. The curse was that they would be scattered.
Where is that?
Okay. That's in Leviticus 27 and in Deuteronomy 28 and 29. So This is what they are facing. They are facing being scattered. But that's not it. That's not all of it. Okay? As you go on in this passage, now they're going to be scattered through the nation. Continuing on, it says, "And Yahweh said to me, a conspiracy or an alliance has been found among the men of Judah and among the inhabitants of Jerusalem." What does God tell us? What does God tell the Israelites not to do? To form alliances. Well, I don't know why they use the word conspiracy, because it doesn't mean a conspiracy. It means there was an alliance. Israel was forming alliances. And at this time, if you look at the history, this is the time when the southern tribes were being attacked by other nations. And they were actually making alliances with other nations in order to protect them. We just talked about that a second ago. What's Israel today done? They've made an alliance with the United States, right? And they're trying to protect themselves through alliances where God says, depend on me. They have turned back to their iniquities of the forefathers, refused to hear my words, and they have gone after other gods to serve them. Part of making alliances with another nation, remember, we've got suzerainty treaties. Okay, part of making alliances with other nations is that you worship and partake in the religion of the nations that you make alliances with. So therefore, Israel, because of the alliances, now they're worshiping other gods. And they're mixing this religion into what they're doing. They've gone after other gods to serve them. The house of Israel and the house of Judah have broken my covenant, which I made with their fathers. Therefore, thus says Yahweh, behold, I will surely bring calamity on them, which they will not be able to escape. And though they cry out to me, I will not listen to them. So what does this seem to indicate? This to me indicates that even if they cry in repentance, God's not going to hear them because of the alliances. Because they're making alliances with other nations, God is not going to hear them even when they cry out. Now, do we find that in the Torah? Well, yes, we do. Because if you look at Exodus 22, verse 20, it says, he who sacrifices to any god except Yahweh only, he shall be utterly destroyed. So there are terms of the covenant that have to do with certain just regular disobedience to the Torah, but there's other terms that pertain to idolatry. And so if Israel had simply stopped keeping Torah and just went their merry way and just forgot about God altogether, they'd be scattered throughout the nations. But when Israel starts making alliances, they come under a different penalty, according to what the Torah says. So here we have Jeremiah, and he's saying, we've got to turn back. We've got to turn back to God quickly, because the penalty is upon us. And as we saw in what happened during the Babylonian captivity and leading right up to it, what happened to most of the people? They died. In fact, most of them were starved to death. They even started eating their own children. So it was a pretty dire situation. So with that background, let's now look at the covenant and look at all the various points in it. So you might want to look there in Jeremiah 31, because I'm not bringing these things back up on the screen. We'll just have to remember that they're there. The first point is this. The new covenant is a future covenant. It's future from Jeremiah's time. It says, what does the text say? Has anybody got it right there? Well, it says that before. It says in Jeremiah 31, there's a, behold, the days are coming. Behold, the days are coming. So the days aren't there yet. So this covenant that God's getting ready to make, if it's a new covenant, is going to be a future covenant. Second point, there is a cutting of the covenant. Now, this is really important, because as we've talked earlier about covenants, when there's a cutting of a covenant, what happens? There has to be a covenant victim. Now, Remember in the situation with Abraham? Abraham took a three-year-old calf or bull, I mean, and cut it in half and walked between the parts. In the situation where Israel took and went into covenant with God, what did Israel do? What did Moses do? He took an oxen and killed it. And they took and sprinkled the blood, half the blood on Israel, on the people of Israel, and half the blood on the altar, symbolizing Israel's part in the covenant and God's part in the covenant. So there has to be a covenant victim. And so when we're looking at the new covenant, do we see a covenant victim? And that's one of the questions that will help us determine if this is a new covenant or if it's not a new covenant. But it's not every place that you see covenant do you see where it says, I will. Karut barit. Karut barit is the word. Cutting a covenant. And it does say it here. It says karut barit. So, therefore, if he's cutting a covenant, we should see a covenant victim. Next point. Well, okay, I'm just stealing it here. Behold, the days are coming, says Yahweh, that I will karut barit, or make a covenant. Actually, look at Young's little translation. If you read the Hebrew, the way the words are parsed out there, it doesn't read exactly that way, but it does mean the same thing. And as we see here, because there is implied a covenant victim, we should see in a covenant victim. And just for our information, when we look at the apostolic scriptures, the Gospels and the Epistles of Paul, or all the Epistles, all the New Testament, we do see Yeshua filling a role that could be a covenant victim. All right. Next thing we see is that the covenant is made with Israel and Judah. It's made with Israel and Judah. Now, some people get confused because as you go on down to in the passage, it says, and this is the covenant that I will make with Israel and doesn't include Judah. And there's a very good reason for this. It's not that Israel is not in covenant at this time and Judah is in covenant at this time. This is a future thing. This is not a current thing. The reason why is because as we look at the text for the entire covenant, we find out that God is gathering all Israel back together. Now, when God made a covenant with Israel at Mount Sinai, did he say, this is my covenant with Israel and my covenant with Judah?
No, they were all together.
They're all together. So whenever Israel is all together, they go under the name Israel. But when Israel is split apart, then we see Israel and Judah. God is, when Jeremiah is talking here, Israel and Judah are split. So this is why he says, this is the covenant I will make with Israel and Judah. But then he goes on and says, when we're making the covenant, it's going to be with Israel, all Israel together, because they're together as a group. All right, next. We find that this covenant is different from the Sinaitic covenant in some regards, because God says it's not going to be according to the same covenant that I made with before. So there's differences in this covenant than there was in the Sinaitic covenant. A few more points here is that we see that it has something to do with marriage, because God is very clear in bringing out, he says, this is my covenant which they broke, though I was a husband to them. So by mentioning that he was a husband to them, sort of indicates that they broke a marriage covenant. And since they broke a marriage covenant, part of the purpose of this quote-unquote new covenant is to restore the marriage relationship. We find that it also requires Torah obedience, just like the Sinaitic covenant. So there again, Christians who want to reject Torah, by definition, wouldn't want to be a part of the new covenant, would they? Because the new covenant requires Torah observance. But there's a difference. Number one is that it's written on their heart. The new covenant would be written on their heart. In other words, the Torah would be written on their heart. That's basically what I meant to say. But there's another interesting thing about it, because like in my New Testament, or in my, I've got the New King James Version. It says, It says, after those days, says Yahweh, I will put my law in their minds and write it on their hearts. Well, the phrase, put the law in their minds, the Hebrew there actually means put it in the midst of them. I will put the law, well, not necessarily. I'm going to put the law in the midst of them and put it on their hearts. Okay, so there's two different things happening here. And we'll discuss that there in just a second. Another thing about the new covenant is that it reverses their status with God. Because at this point, especially the northern tribes, what is their status? And according to Hosea, they are no longer a people. They are not my people. They don't know their identity. They're not a people. But as we can look in Hosea chapter 2, and we'll see that where it talks about a new covenant in Hosea, it says in that they would be betrothed in righteousness and justice, and that mercy would be extended, and ultimately that they would again be my people. So they become the Ami of God, the people of God, my people. Ami is my people. So this is one of the things that the new covenant would do. It makes Israel the people of God again. There again, that doesn't fit into Christian, quote unquote, Christian understanding very well, right? And then another is that all will know Yahweh. All will know Yahweh. All will know God. Now, there's two types of know in the Bible. All right. One is, I know that 2 plus 2 equals 4. But there's also know is that Adam knew Eve. And Adam knowing Eve indicates an intimate relationship, right? Because out of the process of Adam knowing Eve, we had Cain, right? So it says, all will know the Lord. All will know the Lord. And as there again, as you go and look back at the Hosea 2 passage, it indicates an intimate type relationship will be restored with Israel. And that intimate relationship is going to be rooted in faith. Rooted in faith. Now, why do I bring that up? The reason is that you look at the covenant that God made with Israel originally at Mount Sinai, what was the biggest thing lacking in the people? It was faith. They didn't have faith that God would actually do what He said He was going to do. I mean, you look at them, they went through the plagues like we talked earlier today. God's courting Israel all this time, showing God, Israel, all these things that I can do for you. All my greatness, look at all these miracles and all that stuff that's happening. And by the time they got to Mount Sinai, they were all, hyped up and they were ready and they were all in their white linen garments and they were getting ready to become a great priesthood for Israel. And then God started speaking and what did they do? They were scared. They didn't have faith that this voice coming out really loved them. Well, in a way you can understand why, because the pagan gods, you're all taught to be fearful of the pagan gods, because the pagan gods were gods that you had to appease, otherwise they were going to kill you. In fact, they wanted to kill you, but the only way to keep from being killed was through giving them things and sacrificing your daughters and all this type of stuff. This is what they had grown up with, but this is not the God that God was trying to show them that He was. But when that voice came off that mountain, they got scared. And I would submit that from that point on, you see Israel scared all the time. They're not trusting in God to do the things that God said He would do. And so faith was the big problem in this relationship. A lot of people would say that the problem was the lack of the Holy Spirit. But I would reject that concept, because the Holy Spirit was just as accessible to them as it is to us. today. And just like it was with them, how many people today, though we understand that the Holy Spirit is accessible to us, how many people today have the Holy Spirit? So,
not many.
So,
what did you say before? When is the point where they stopped? At Sinai.
At the get-go, basically, in my view.
Well, when they heard the voice.
When they heard the voice, yeah.
They allowed fear. But it's a funny thing that God continually told his people, fear not.
Oh, yeah.
Fear not. Yeah. Being afraid is something that was sort of built in.
Right. Well, it's a flaw.
You shout at somebody and they're going to be afraid.
It's a human flaw. Okay. All right, there's a couple of other points here that we want to look at also, and these are what we would consider outside of the normal covenant text. And that is the passage right before that. If you go up to verse 29 of Jeremiah 31, it says, "In those days they shall say no more, the fathers have eaten sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge." Well, what that means is that the fathers are doing bad things, and therefore hunger has devastated the country. The term "teeth are on edge" indicates that they're gritting at each other. There's nothing to eat. Okay? But as it goes on down, it says, verse 30, "But everyone shall die for his own iniquity. Every man who eats the sour grapes, his teeth shall be set on edge," not the children's teeth. So, what Jeremiah is talking about is going to happen is a time when the sins of a few do not affect the company as a whole. And as we know, under the terms of the covenant at Mount Sinai, when the people, in fact, even before then, when the few didn't follow God, it often affected the whole, right? Well, that's not the same thing though that we're talking about. You take, for instance, the sin of Achan. Okay, the sin of Achan was a very small thing, but a lot of people died. The sin of David in numbering the people. Whose sin was it? It was David. But what happened? A lot of people died. Okay, so the sins of one person affected another person. So what we're seeing here is that what Jeremiah say leading up to the new covenant is that there will be a time when that's no longer takes place. That a person will pay for his own sins and that will not affect another person.
Was Achan the one that heard the battle of Ai and lost him?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that's one of the points. So first, the new covenant, quote unquote, is not... Uh-oh, what happened? Okay. The new covenant is not necessarily corporate in nature. All right? The second point is... Is the computer still up? Okay. Okay, let me press function F7. Oh, here it is. Never mind. All right. The next point is... All right, well, let me just go ahead with this. No one suffers for the sins of another. And in effect, what we're seeing is that out of a subset of Israel, you're going to see the Israel of God appear. Because as people pay the penalties for their mistakes and that only, that but what that leaves is only the people who are walking in accordance with God. And we'll develop that, I think, in here in just a minute. The second thing is in chapter 32, verse 40. Chapter 32, verse 40 says, "And I will make an everlasting covenant with them, that I will not turn away from doing them good, but I will put my fear in their hearts, so that they will not depart from me. Yes, I will rejoice over them to do them good, and I will assuredly plant them in the land with all my heart and with all my soul.
Is this still Jeremiah?
No. Well, this is Jeremiah. This is Jeremiah 32, verse 40. So what we see here is a time when God is so confident in Israel that there will no longer be curses. There will be no need for a blessing and curses chapter or a curses portion in the blessings and curses. And Israel will be in many aspects like Abraham was. And that God knows Israel's heart to the point that he is confident in saying that this is what's going to happen. Remember with Abraham, when Abraham offered up Isaac afterwards, God says, I know your heart, that you will never depart from obeying me. It's basically what he said. So when God is that convinced of your desire and your character, then he can make a statement like he does here in verse 40, that he will plant you eternally, basically, in the lands where it says. So let's take a quick look here at Yeshua's role, if this is a new covenant. And remember, the New Testament does make two references to the New Covenant. And actually, in many Bibles, you'll see four references. But in two of those references, in the Epistles of Paul and in the book of Hebrews, the word new or covenant are added. And so there's only two true places in the Bible, in the New Testament, where we see the term new covenant. One is in Luke 22, verse 20. And the other is in, I think, 1 Corinthians 7, or something like that, where Paul, talking about the Luke 22, verse 20, and the other one is where Paul's talking about Yeshua's last night and the last meal that he had. All right? So let's look at this. The typical understanding of what Yeshua says here, and let's just look at the Luke 22, 20. Has anybody got that?
I do.
What does it say? Okay, so that word New Testament, the Greek word there for testament is diakathia or something like that. And it's most often used for the term covenant. It is the word that the priest and who wrote the Septuagint used to translate the Hebrew word brit. So that word would best be new covenant. So Yeshua is saying, this is the new covenant in my blood. And the typical understanding of that by New Covenant Christians is that Yeshua takes all sin upon himself. And I would not disagree with that at all. I think that is certainly the case, but I don't think that's the main purpose of what Yeshua is saying. Because remember, the Israelites and the Jewish people in his day, they understood covenants better than we do. And they understood that to have a covenant, you had to have a covenant victim. They were familiar with the sacrifices. They were familiar with the intercessory, whatever the word is, the part of that an animal plays in taking a person's place. Hey, what? Well, a substitute. The animal is a substitute for the people. Yes. Well, let's just go on with this here. there's a substitute aspect that we learn through the sacrifices that we today don't really understand because we don't study it enough and all that stuff, and we certainly are not taking place, or we're not taking our animals up and actually laying hands on them and asking God to put our sins on that animal. But they did. And they understood these things. So when Yeshua says this, they understand what he's saying. I believe that Yeshua is the covenant victim. And I think this can be substantiated. There again, when there was Abraham making the covenant, the covenant victim was a bull. When the covenant was made with Israel, it was the oxen. Now, there's something interesting about the oxen. What is the word Aleph in Paleo-Hebrew? What's the symbolic picture? It's an oxen. Okay. So, and it also stands for the strong, the great. That's why the word father is Abba, the great one of the house. It's the ox of the house, you might say. So, when Israel took upon itself the covenant at Mount Sinai, an oxen was killed, which basically is saying that the representation of God was what was split in half. Okay, so now we come to the new covenant, and here's Yeshua saying, this is the blood of the covenant. Well, what happened to the blood of this oxen right here? It was sprinkled on the people. Half of the blood was sprinkled on the people. But what did Yeshua say? Yeshua said, take the cup. This cup is representative of my blood. And when you drink it, then you should drink it. I suggest that this is symbolic of you are actually entering into a covenant when you take that and when you drink that wine. You're actually entering into a covenant with God. And by drinking that wine, like they did, they would understand that an animal died to provide that. But in this case, Yeshua is saying, I'm dying to provide that blood so that we can be in covenant together. All right, so let's look here at this. Is that the way it's looking on my screen? Let me see. Well, I'll just have to tell you what it's all about then. Okay. It's only missing a couple of things. Let's compare the Sinaitic covenant with the new covenant. First off, when is it established? The Sinaitic covenant was established at Mount Sinai after Israel had been delivered. Okay? The new covenant says it will be in the last days when Israel is in deep distress and calls out for deliverance. The time of Jacob's trouble. Or the tribulation. Some of us call it the tribulation. The parties involved are going to be Israel and Judah. And it was the Sinaitic covenant was applied corporately. The new covenant will be between Israel and Judah, but it will be applied individually. And out of the new covenant will come a people who are walking in God's way. Remember Paul says what? Not all Israel is Israel. So there are people within Israel who are walking the way of Israel, and there are people within Israel that are not walking the way of Israel. They're not walking a Hebraic walk. The purpose of the Sinaitic covenant was to establish the covenant made with Abraham. The purpose of the new covenant is to restore Israel back to life after they were banished and under the death penalty as per the terms of the Sinaitic covenant. Remember, we talked about that earlier. In Jeremiah 31, they were banished because God says, if you don't walk my walk, you're going to be cast out and you're going to be scattered among the nations. And this is the case of Israel and getting ready to be the case of Judah at this time. But it also said that if you make alliances, you offer, and you worship idols, then you're going to die. So Israel, in a way, and I would suggest a very significant way, was under a death penalty. Yes.
Sinaitic covenant. The purpose is that to reestablish the covenant made with the people?
No. I said to establish the covenant made with Abraham because Abraham never saw the land. I mean, Abraham never saw his people, his families, go into the land and establish themselves as a nation. When God called Israel out, it was to fulfill the covenant with Abraham. Amen.
But with the words you have up there, to establish the covenant which made with Abraham, the covenant that was made with Abraham was made with Abraham.
Right.
But it was about the children going to the land.
It was about, yeah. And actually, God uses the words that I'm doing this to establish my covenant with Abraham.
Yeah. Well, to fulfill his end of the bargain.
Right. That's what establishing it is, yeah.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Okay, and who was the covenant victim? In the Sinaitic covenant, it was an oxen, which I would suggest is portrayal of God himself. In the New Covenant, we see it's Yeshua. And based on our theology, we may say they're one and the same. Okay? The covenant sign, this is sort of interesting. The covenant sign of the Sinaitic covenant was what? The Sabbath. It was the Sabbath.
What
verse do you remember reference to that? It's in Exodus 31. Yeah, Exodus 31. But the sign of the New Covenant is Torah observance.
Wow. But it comes from a physical part that comes back to Abraham.
Yeah, but as we go through and study this more, and I haven't brought out everything that we see that's there, but if you go on into the New Testament scriptures, what does John say? In fact, I may have it quoted here. I don't have it right here. But in the book of 1 John, I think it's 1 John 3, verse 6, it says, this is how you will know that you are God's, or you are God's people, if you keep my commandments.
That's true.
So the sign of the new covenant is the keeping of the commandments. Now, to illustrate this real quickly, there are a lot of Sabbath keepers out here today, out in the world today, right? Seventh-day Adventists, okay? The Seventh-day Adventists keep the Sabbath, but what do they don't do? They don't do the holy days. And they don't do a lot of the things that are in Torah, okay? You've got the Church of God Seventh Day, okay? Up in wherever they're at, they're all over the place. They keep the Sabbath, but they don't keep the commandments. They don't keep the festivals, and many of the commandments they say are done away with. The church I came out of, Worldwide Church of God, and its offshoots, they keep a lot of the commandments, they keep the Sabbath, but they don't keep them all. A lot of them they believe are done away with. So just being Sabbath observant does not make you a new covenant person. New covenant implies that you're going to keep all the Torah. Okay? Is there an intimate relationship under the Sinaitic covenant? Well, yes, there was supposed to be. God intended for there to be a marriage relationship there, but what was the first thing they did on the mountain? They told their husband, I don't want to hear you talking to me anymore. Okay?
Okay. But that was corporal.
Right.
But all the stories that we find in Scripture were those who accepted it mm-hmm. personally. I mean, Hannah, she goes to Eli, and what happens? I mean, so all
Lisa, you know that we're not talking about every last individual.
Right.
Okay.
So
but that's what I've been saying here.
Right.
Corporate. Okay. Corporately, Israel rejected the marriage relationship.
Right.
But in the New Covenant, what do we see? It says all Israel will know Yahweh. All Israel will have an intimate covenant relationship with God. So, what's the difference? The difference is that where before part of Israel rejected, most of Israel rejected the covenant or the intimate relationship. In this case, those who in the new covenant, those who reject the intimate relationship are not a part of the new covenant. Okay? The next one up there is the location of the covenant terms. Where were the covenant terms kept in the Sinaitic covenant?
In the temple.
In the Ark of the Covenant. The tablets were written on by the finger of God, and they were put in the Ark of the Covenant. They're out of sight of the people, weren't they? And so the people were dependent upon the priest to teach them about the Torah, right? God says in the sign in the new covenant that the Torah will be in their midst. And I would suggest what that means, contrary to what's commonly written, I would suggest because what the words, if you look at the Hebrew simply means in the midst. It can be in the midst of your heart. It can be in the midst of your field. It can be in the midst of anything. But it says it will be in your midst. In other words, Torah is going to be written on your heart, but it's also going to be visible out there. Maybe they're going to put it in the state capitol building or whatever, you know. They're going to put the Torah out there for people to see. It will be in their midst.
And you're talking about the Messianic Age.
Messianic Age. Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. What's the duration? In both cases, it's forever. And what are the requirements? Under the Sinaitic covenant, the requirement was that if the people walked in God's way, God would let them live in the land. In the New Covenant text, we see that there are no ifs. Because God says, I am going to firmly plant you in the land. I will firmly plant you. So, my question then would be, is the new covenant new? And let's look at here. Before we do that, before we've talked about the covenants being nested, where the covenant with Abraham was dependent on the covenant of Noah, and the Sinaitic covenant was dependent upon the covenant with Abraham. Without any of these covenants, you couldn't have the following covenant. Well, before I would have said the new covenant doesn't fit this pattern, but now I believe that the new covenant firmly fits this pattern, because the new covenant is formed on the basis of the old covenant, or the Sinaitic covenant, because it's still Torah observant and all that. And as we look at this, also let's think about this: how many people are included in the covenant with Noah? All people are included in the covenant with Noah.
Well, all people,
because, I mean, he can't flood my neighbor without flooding me. All right, all people are in covenant.
Yeah.
Who all is included in the covenant with Abraham? It's all Abraham's descendants, basically. That was passed down through Isaac and Jacob, but is basically all Israel is included in that. But keep in mind, Ishmael also was circumcised, right? And so God saw to it that Ishmael also had a kingdom. So it's passed down through more, basically, than just Isaac and Jacob, in a way. Then the Sinaitic covenant was with Israel, and it was totally dependent upon that with Abraham. But in the Sinaitic covenant, Esau's not a part of this. Ishmael's not a part of this. The Sinaitic covenant is only with the descendants of Jacob. So we get on down here to the new covenant. Is all the people that are involved in this covenant necessarily part of this covenant?
No.
But it's a subset. Yeah. It's going to basically be those people who will take and look at the covenant victim and say, whatever happened to that covenant victim happens to me if I don't walk in the terms of this covenant. You could use that term, though it's not a biblical term.
Circumcised in the heart.
Yeah. So is the new covenant really new? I would say yes. It is. Huh?
Uh-oh.
I should have run it out of my computer. Why, yes, yeah. The new covenant is, in my opinion, a new covenant made with Israel. It does not take and negate any of the old covenant. Or any of the Sinaitic covenant. In fact, I would suggest that in the end of days, there are going to be people who are part of the new covenant, and there will be Israelites who are part of the Sinaitic covenant and still part of the Sinaitic covenant. But from those people will be a subset of people who are part of the new covenant. And as we look at the bride and the bridegroom and the 10 virgins and all that stuff, that sort of leads us to an understanding that there is going to be a people who are considered the bride, and there are going to be those who are considered friends of the bride or the bridesmaids. Okay? The bridesmaids are not the bride. Okay? No, I didn't say that. In fact, I think I've been saying totally contrary to that.
Bob and I were talking about this, that this bride concept was with Israel way back when God told Samuel, don't weep, because the people want a king, because what it is the people have rejected me, that I should not go with them.
Right.
But the whole circle is, back where you're talking about, God is going to reign over these, and that's the marriage, that's the intimacy.
Really, really, before we get into this, really what boils down to is this, and I know I got to quit, I'm running over again, but what it boils down to this is that in men and women, there are two basic needs. Women want what?
Security.
Security. What do men want?
Respect.
Respect. All right? God offered Israel security, and he never backed down from offering Israel security. But what did Israel do with God in terms of respect?
Disrespected.
They were totally disrespectful. In fact, when they got to the land and they refused to go in, that was the ultimate in disrespect for a man. And so it is indeed a marital relationship. And if we look at it more intimately or more like that, when we get down to the case of Samuel, God, what the children of Israel were telling God was that, we don't even want you to act like the head of the household anymore.
Yeah.
We want to bring some guy from outside into our home and let him run the house. Yeah. So, anyway. Bottom line is, with the new covenant does not change the covenant that God made at Mount Sinai. Jeremiah 31, verse 37 says, thus says Yahweh, if heaven above can be measured and the foundations are searched out beneath, I will also cast off all the seed of Israel for all that they have done, says Yahweh. This is one of the last portions of the New Covenant passage. And so what that is saying is that the covenant that Israel already had still stands. It's still there. It's just, I'm making a new covenant for those who will rise above. In Jeremiah 32, verse 47, actually we'll pass over this because we read this earlier. So what's the conclusions? And this is the conclusions to this entire talk about covenants, because I think it's important. I wanted us all to realize that we do have a covenant, that it's important to realize you are still a part of the covenant with God and all of the covenants. And along with the covenants come the covenant responsibilities and the covenant signs. Because without the covenant signs, you can't identify who's in the covenant. But God works through covenants. He expects follow-through on the part of both parties. So if you say you're going to do something within the covenant, you've got to do it. Just as God says and does what he says he will do in terms of the covenant. Covenants are built within other covenants. And so you cannot have the new covenant without having the Sinaitic covenant. And you can't have the Sinaitic covenant without having the covenant with Abraham. So all of these things are still in effect. All of these are needed in order for a new covenant Christian to be a new covenant Christian. And God makes provisions to maintain the covenants. And so Yeshua coming along, he plays many roles. But one of the roles of Yeshua is that he is the covenant victim on which the new covenant is established. Finish up here, Deuteronomy 7, verse 9. Therefore, know that the Lord your God, he is God, the faithful God who keeps covenant and mercy for 1,000 generations with those who love him and keep his commandments. So, shalom aleichem. And again, I apologize for this going a little bit long. It's just sort of hard to get this information in just 45 minutes.